Hello, this is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to read articles from the April 2024 Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with the Mojo interview with Lenny Kravitz, and then Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On album, how that was created, and then a classic album review of Led Zeppelin III by, of course, Led Zeppelin. And here's the Mojo interview with Lenny Kravitz. Miles and Duke were his parents' pals. Romeo Blue, his Bowie-ish false start. And 35 years since his Begelling debut, the records show that he's always been more than a fashion plate. I've used my gifts to amplify love, says Lenny Kravitz. We have cows. It's a glorious California morning, but Lenny Kravitz's mind is in Brazil, specifically the former coffee plantation outside Rio de Janeiro that he's transformed into a farm. We do bamboo, eucalyptus, coffee, and most other fruit and vegetables that grow in the state of Rio. We don't eat the cows, of course, he adds. We just let them graze, eat grass, and live. Rather like his cows, for the 35 years since his debut album, Let Love Rule, catapulted him to instant European fame, and eventually American renown, Kravitz has grazed and lived. There's been grass, too. For the past month, however, he's been in Los Angeles, fine-tuning his 12th album, The Sparkling Blue Electric Light, the longest album of his career, and one which distills almost all that is good about Lenny Kravitz. Soon, he'll be at the Golden Globes, where his trombone-drenched Road to Freedom from Rustin, the biopic of gay civil rights activist Bayard Rustin, will lose out in the Best Original Song category to Billie Eilish tune from Barbie. Right now, though, he can't sit still. Sunglasses go on. He sits in the sun. He goes to get some water. Sunglasses go off. On his return, the sun has moved on. Where's the sunniest spot, he wonders. Kravitz, now 59, has always been restless. Raised in New York by Cy Kravitz, his television producer, Russian-Jewish father. Actually, they were from Kyiv. So they'd be Ukrainian Jews now. And his African-American Bahamian mother, the actress Roxy Roker. He fitted between his maternal grandparents in Brooklyn, Bedford-Stuyvesant, where Lenny was Eddie, and the family home is Uptown Manhattan, where Lenny was Lenny. When her boy was 10, Roxy secured a lead role on the groundbreaking interracial comedy The Jeffersons, and the pair decamped to Los Angeles. He joined the California Boys Choir, his first gig, Mahler's Third, with the L.A. Philharmonic at the Hollywood Bowl, briefly became Romeo Blue, and began the journey to Let Love Rule, loosely based around his relationship with Cosby Show actor Lisa Bonet and the arrival of their daughter, Zoe. 11 always varied, mostly excellent, sometimes boundary-pushing albums later. Kravitz is a global superstar with sidelines in design, painting, brand, and endorsements, and acting. In the autumn, he'll take a break from the Blue Electric Light World Tour to make an as-yet unnamed film about a fictional musician. "I'm enjoying it more than ever," he insists. "I'm hungrier and more inspired than I've ever been. I see a lot of people, friends even, who are not pleased anymore, not inspired anymore. They've become jaded and burnt out. That's not where I am. I have a fire underneath me that's greater than ever." What's your first musical memory? Tchaikovsky Symphony, I can't remember which one. But I had this toy, show and tell, a plastic TV set looking thing with a record player on top. You stuck a slide in, watched the screen, and heard the music. I'd sing along to this Tchaikovsky number. Then it was Jackson 5, Motown, Curtis Mayfield, Al Green, R&B Soul, Jazz, Miles Davis, Coltrane, Parker, Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, Kenny Burrell, Wes Montgomery, and Gospel. You see, when my parents went out, they took me with them. They could have left me at home, but I got to see and hear all these great music and theater. Given your parents' job and roles as night people, your upbringing could have been feral. Well, it could, but it wasn't. I come from a life of discipline. My mom gave me loving discipline and the values of hard work. Even my dad, there was militaristic discipline. How does an infant cope with seeing their mom on stage, being different people every night? It was surreal to see her playing these characters when I was at a very young age. I was like, "Who's that?" It was amazing to watch her transform into somebody else, but that's how I grew up. Few five-year-olds have Duke Ellington sing happy birthday to them. To me, it was normal. He was just this nice guy with a white suit, slicked back silver hair, and a goatee, who was a friend of my parents. When I saw him play on my fifth birthday, his orchestra stopped playing. He said, "There's a young man in the audience, and it's his birthday." Then I'm sat on his lap, and they start playing Happy Birthday. Only years later did I go, "Wow, I didn't realize what an education I was having." And seeing the Jackson 5 at Madison Square Garden as a six-year-old changed your life? Absolutely. They blew my mind. Their singles were the first records I had. I knew the orchestrations. I knew the words. I knew everything. From that day forward, nothing was the same. Did you have trouble establishing your own personal and racial identity? I didn't, which is quite the marvel. I had no understanding of prejudice, no understanding that having different skin tones meant something more than the visual. I was in a household with every color, every background, every religion, so I thought that's what human beings were. I'm Jewish, I'm Bohemian, I'm from Europe, the Caribbean, and American South, and we celebrated all our holidays, all our traditions. I didn't know there was an issue until other kids told me. Then I became confused. But my mother taught me to celebrate everything I was. It was a beautiful way to grow up. You were an accidental sponge. Yeah, I would agree. That's why the music isn't in a box. It's an accumulation of everything. Your middle name, Albert, is a tribute to your maternal grandfather. How did he shape your life? Albert Roker was a great example of growing in life, a person who was open to change and open to learning. At 9 years of age, he had to become the man of the household because his father died. He had to support four siblings and an ailing mother, so he never got to finish school. He became this philosopher, this self-educated person who was always taking classes, reading, and learning. He wasn't an I know best granddad. Instead, he would say, "This is the best way I know, and I'll teach it to you. But when you find a better way, you teach me." He's why I always feel like there's a new life every day. Miles Davis didn't hang out with many preteens, did he? Well, to everyone else, he must have been Miles Davis. But to me, this guy was the husband of Cicely Tyson, my mom's best friend and my godmother. I knew he played the trumpet, but I didn't know what he stood for. It must have been weird for him. I just liked the way he spoke to me. Uncannily accurate impersonation. "Lenny, how you doing?" When I met people at high school who idolized him, I was like, "Oh, shit." How did moving to Los Angeles affect this New York boy? I discovered rock, but the key factor was joining the California Boys Choir from 11 to 15 as a first and then second alto. I learned to sight read, which I've completely lost, to sing phonetically in 15 languages, and via osmosis. I was taking in orchestration, counterpoint, and harmony, but not realizing what I'm going to do with it. When did you commit yourself to music? Well, I sort of knew from a small child, but in high school, I had a dream I'd play in a club or restaurant while I'd have a girlfriend with a typewriter who was a writer. But I was a stone-cold New Yorker, and I missed it. After high school, cheap air travel meant I could travel back and forth. In New York, I became the guy who helped others develop their sound. You could come to me with a framework of a song, and because I could play all the instruments, I'll help you finish it. I was happy being a guitarist. I wasn't writing, and I'd no thoughts of being a solo artist. Why on earth did you become Romeo Blue? I was very insecure about my name. I thought Lenny Kravitz was the most un-rock and roll name you could have. Some friends gave me the nickname Romeo, which was silly. I added the blue to it and became this Romeo Blue character. He was very odd, a mix of David Bowie, Prince, and Rick James. He had the hairdo, wore the thrift store clothes, and he had the blue contact lenses. But I felt like I was hiding the real me. I got to a place where it was, fuck this, I'm going to take my name and deal with it. Romeo Blue was part of finding myself. He led me back to me. Romeo Blue almost got a deal, though, didn't he? Well, when the music started coming to me, I spent my college money on making demos, which blew my parents' mind. I ended up getting listened to by Miles Copeland, the brother of police drummer Stewart, who had IRS records. He wanted to sign me, and I was so excited, but he didn't want me to produce myself. He wanted Martin Rushnet, this English guy who'd produced the Human League's Dare and, for IRS, the Go-Go's. I brought my dad to the meeting. Miles also wanted my publishing, but my dad said, absolutely not. Things were getting a little heated between Miles and my dad, and it ended up with me thinking my dad's fucked up my record deal. But he knew exactly what he was doing. He wasn't a lawyer, but he knew enough about the record business and publishing. I appreciated that, but not until later. Were you almost in the black Duran Duran? A&M wanted four cute young black guys with a European sound. They offered all this money and a chance to make an album in Europe. At the time, a shitty Ford Escort, which I rented for $4.99 a day, was both my car and my house. But when it came to sign, Something in my spirit would not let me do it. The other guys were mad at me because I'd blown the deal and the band fell through. It was utterly ridiculous. The record company guy thinks I'm an idiot. I think I'm an idiot, but I walked out of it forever. As Let Love Rule developed, so did the dreadlocks. An accident. Honest to God, this is the truth. When I moved in with Lisa Bonet, as friends at first, I brought my guitars and keyboards, but I forgot my comb. Next thing I know, dreadlocks were forming. I remember saying to Lisa, I've got to cut them out. She was, no, 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 they look great. Let Love Rule was simply everything me and Lisa talked about. After you signed to Virgin America as Lenny Kravitz, what kind of pop star did you want to be? I had no idea. I had the music, but I hadn't performed yet. Romeo Blue was a persona, and while I played on stage with people, I never did a show as Romeo Blue. I had no plan. Why did you break in Europe before the U.S.? America was very formatted, and my music wasn't black enough or white enough. Europe was hipper. Virgin sent me to London and put me up at the Pembridge Court Hotel, a bed and breakfast run by two ladies. I did all the promotion they asked, and I was in heaven. I played The Borderline early on, and Terrence Trent D'Arby, Knee-High Cherry, and Jazzy B all showed up. I didn't think about not being accepted in America. I knew nothing. It's quite beautiful to look back and think how innocent I was. Well, you started collaborating straight away. A year after Let Love Rule, you and Ingrid Chavez wrote Justify My Love for Madonna. Oh, I knew that track wasn't for me. I'd met Madonna out in the clubs, and we used to have fun. I called her and said, I have a number one song for you. She said, no, you don't. I jumped in a cab with my cassette. She's very playful and funny and says, where's my number one song? I played it twice. She says, let's record it. Although she wouldn't come to Hoboken, where I was recording. It was her biggest hit for many, 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 many years. While the Jean Baptiste Mondio video was banned by MTV, the label sold it as a video cassette, and it exploded. People were lined up around the block buying these things. And here's a little bit of that song that Lenny Kravitz wrote for Madonna. Madonna sings it. The song is titled Justify My Love. The second LP, Mama Said, was born of depression, wasn't it? I love that album, but yes, it was. Life gave me what it took to make that record, and it was a beautiful experience. But there was a lot of darkness. I was going through the breakup with Lisa. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. but making Mama sad helped me cope with the darkness. Slash and Sean Lennon are on there. Slash was my high school buddy, but Sean's like my little brother. I met him when Yoko came to a show in Geneva. She really liked me, and I ended up becoming friends with her and the family. Sean was in the studio hallway playing the piano. He said he was just messing about, but the chords became all I ever wanted. I love the Mama Said album. It's very raw. A little bit of that song, All I Ever Wanted, from Lenny Kravitz, from his album, Mama Said. That riff to Are You Gonna Be My Way come from? Well, it happened in 5 minutes. In 1992, I was in Paris making the Are You Gonna Go My Way album and Vanessa Paradis album, Vanessa Paradis, at the same time. She just made an LP with Serge Gainsbourg and might have done another. But he died. When I was asked, I didn't know who she was, but I took the gig. I'd do my stuff during the day and hers after five. One day, the studio people are clearing up our stuff. Vanessa's waiting outside, and me and Craig Ross, my guitarist and partner, were just jamming around, me on drums, him on guitar. All of a sudden, we hit something. I said, wait a minute, let's record that. We did it in one take, and I wrote some lyrics the following morning. I knew I dug it. I knew there was an energy, but it was so raw and so nasty, a beautiful mess at a time when everything on the radio was very produced and very clean. You worked with Mick Jagger on two of his solo albums. Did you feel he was a bit lost without the Stones? No, no, no. Mick enjoyed his solo time. For him, it was a holiday. We collaborated on Bill Withers' Use Me for 1993's Wandering Spirit, but we wrote God Gave Me Everything on Goddess in the Doorway 2001. I had the melody, but no words apart from a bit of chorus. He came to my Roxy studio in Miami. I mumbled some words. He took a pen and paper, and 30 minutes later, had the lyrics. He goes into the vocal booth and starts singing from top to bottom perfectly. I say, my God, that was amazing. And he says, we'll get the real vocal later. He tried over and over again. Of course, we used the original. Was 1995 Circus the closest you've come to all-out rock? Well, it's got a lot of heaviness and dirginess. I hadn't changed, but circumstances around me and people's reactions to me had. As opposed to being Lenny Kravitz, I was Lenny Kravitz. I was getting extravagant, renting chateaus in France to record jet-setting, having a relationship with Vanessa. I'd leave the chateau, drive 2 hours to Paris and party. People weren't happy with me. On top of that, my mother was fighting cancer, and she was coming over to hang out. I was all over the place. The result is a fan favorite. For the real fans, Circus is the one. Making it was cathartic. But then my mom passed, and I had to be on the road in 5 days. Interesting times. You started on the funk album, the great lost Lenny Kravitz LP, while you were working on Circus. Any sign of it yet? Oh, it's still to come out. Some people still think those songs became Baptism 2004, but that's not the case at all. I wasn't having a good time making Circus. I thought, fuck it. I'm taking a break. I went to New Orleans with Craig. I've always loved New Orleans architecture, food, music, and history. It doesn't feel like the U.S. We saw Aretha Franklin from the side of the stage. We started hanging out in clubs every night, drinking, eating, partying, and sitting in with bands. Then, as I'd saved some money up, I bought a house from a woman of color on Daphne Street in the French Quarter. The wood was old, funky, and mystical, so I knew it was mine. Now I wanted to make music. The funk album? Exactly. I rented Alan Toussaint's C. Saint studio, where the Meters, Professor Longhair, and Earl King had recorded. That was the beginning of the funk album. What happened? Well, it wasn't finished, so I put it away. In 2004, I pulled it out again, and I've kept adding to it and molding it ever since. It's long, a double triple LP. What's interesting is that it's a record of many versions of myself now. It's going to come out. When, Len? I don't actually know. After the next album? Or the one after that? Working with Michael Jackson must have felt like completing the circle, which began in Madison Square Garden. Michael was doing Invincible, and John McClane at his label asked if I had anything for Mike. I hadn't. But I immediately wrote, I Can't Make It Another Day, played all the instruments, and did a guide vocal. Michael came into the studio. While I play music loud, he played it louder than anything I've ever heard. He said he loved it and started dancing. He did the vocal straight away and insisted I stop him if it wasn't right. My head's going back to when I was 6 years old at the MSG. But we're just two guys working. When he said, I haven't had this much fun since Quincy, I took it as the biggest compliment of my career. Why didn't it make Invincible? Well, John thought it was too jarring for a groovy, mellow record with butterflies and those beautiful songs. Then Michael died. A decade on, I Can't Make It Another Day appeared on Michael, which was an interesting album. I wish it had been on Invincible. After 8 albums, 2008's It Is Time for a Love Revolution finally gave you an American top 5 album. Everybody knew Lenny Kravitz, so why so long? I actually didn't know that. My records are slow growers, which I'm good with. I don't follow the trends. I'm not trying to make commercial music. I could have done. I could have been right. I'm going go for hits. But I've always done what I wanted, taken the time to grow and experiment, whether people dig it or not. I'm in this for the long haul. Some people do a big explosion and leave, either by dying or stopping. That's not me. I'm just getting started. 2011's Black and White America, Ray's Vibration, 7 years later, and Blue Electric Light are Bahamas albums. Doesn't a place so laid back stifle creativity? No. It enhances creativity. I'm an antenna. I pick up what's floating around. I don't wake up, get a coffee, and go to work. I don't live that way. I wait until I hear something, which can come in a dream, or sitting or walking around, and the Bahamas is great for that. I'm literally grounded since I don't wear shoes. My feet are in the dirt, on the beach, or in the jungle. I live a very basic life there, and it's quiet. It's a place where I can hear. On Blue Electric Light, you're still singing about love, but you've never been as poppy as on Human. Well, I was 2 years into a 3-year tour when the planet shut down. I do not say this lightly because I understand people were sick and people died. But for me, it was a blessing. Time was suddenly an open concept, and I had not experienced anything like that since I was a child. I was in the Bahamas in a bubble of 8, including Craig. Apart from not being able to see my daughter Zoe for 2 years, she was in London making the Batman. I was in the best physical, mental, and spiritual place of my life. I spent time in prayer and meditation, and it was phenomenal. It was a reboot of my life. Did you get creative? I made 4 albums worth of music. There are Threads, It's Me, It's My Voice, My Sensibilities, My Playing, My Producing, etc., etc. But I never repeated myself. I don't do anything twice. I'm not able to do that for some reason. I'm never the same human being as I was a couple of years ago. This means that every LP is a completely new life for me. A new way of doing things, hearing things and playing. When you listen to all the albums in a row, from Sonics to songwriting and production, they're all different. Do you feel critically undervalued? First of all, I don't need validation. I'm not that person. I know who I am, I know what I do, and I feel good about it. Then I look at the people gravitating toward me, from Michael Jackson to Mick Jagger. They all called me, remember, the legendary folk who supported me, and I know they get it. I can name 50 of them. That's my validation. Do your extracurricular activities, design, acting, etc., get into the way of music? Well, I wouldn't think so. Whether I'm taking photos, designing, landscaping, or painting, music is the nucleus. That's what I breathe, and that's what gives me life. But look, Kravitz Design is serious. We've made the Architectural Digest Top 100 for 3 years in a row. I'm just as passionate about designing as music. I love it. It's another medium in which I get to express myself. When I come back to other things, there's more energy. Does that make you immune to the music industry's financial downturn? Or it's not as lucrative as you might think. I spend a lot of money with a design company. It's there to keep my employees living more than what it does for me. There are deals here and there that do well, but somehow God provides. It hasn't always been easy, but I just keep at it. You've had your bronchial troubles. Are you physically well? Never been healthier. Being on the road can be treacherous. Everybody's catching something somewhere. But I take really good care of myself. I eat well, I train well, and recently I've increased my level of discipline in taking care of myself. The return has been really good. Do you have any regrets? Well, there are moments where if our lives were played on a screen for others to watch, we wouldn't want everyone to see, but I have no regrets. even when we're doing things that may not be what we'd like to think our character is. It's part of ourselves. I've always been myself. I've learned what I want and don't want, what I like and don't like. I live with that. You can either be in denial or embrace it and keep moving. What's been your contribution? Well, I've used my gifts to amplify love. That's what I'm here for. That's what we're all here for. I just happen to use the medium of music. I feel good about that. How would you like to be remembered? Wow, that's deep. As a person who was true to themselves, who believed in love and God and creativity and humanity. Okay, and now we move on to the Marvin Gaye article titled Marvin Gaye Says, Let's Get It On. In 1973, the conflicted Prince of Soul was enjoying a new $1 million Motown deal. He was also battling writer's block and had a separation from the boss's sister to navigate. The moment brought forth a charged song cycle, which reconciled his prejudiced spiritual and erotic drives into an ecstatic whole. Then its success meant he had to tour it. Some part of him thought he was a fraud, recalled collaborators and friends, but he made it look easy. Dan Peek. By 1973, Motown had completed their move from Detroit to Los Angeles, and they had a studio on Romaine Street. L.A. was a small music community. Everyone knew everyone. David Ritz. Marvin was reluctant to make the move. He didn't really want to go to L.A., but he was competitive. The Jackson 5 were having big hits, and he wanted to make his L.A. statement, make a grand single and album, and prove he could make it there. Ed Townsend. I was shopping songs around I had written in New York. I heard Marvin's had been asking about me. I think he liked how I had worked with Nelson Riddle. And I went to Marvin's apartment on Categris Avenue with Let's Get It On, Please Stay Once You Go Away, If I Should Die Tonight, and Keep Getting It On. So what became side one of Let's Get It On? He hadn't had a hit for a while, and Motown were keen to get him back in the studio and recording. I played the songs to him on the piano, and he said he'd record them if I would produce them. I said I would if he called up Berry Gordy and told him. So he called him up straight away and told him, I got the job. And here's a little bit of that famous Marvin Gaye song, Let's Get It On. EP. I got the call to go to the studio, Hitsville West, Los Angeles, and I was walking in, and arranger Renee Hall was there, and producer Ed Townsend was there, and Marvin Gaye was there. Then there was the band drummer Paul Humphrey, pianist Joe Sample, bassist Wynton Fetter. I was handed a sheet with all the chord changes on, and we started rehearsing. We did 3 songs in 3 hours. The first song we did was If I Should Die Tonight, and the second was Let's Get It On. E.T. I wrote Let's Get It On in alcohol rehabilitation. It was about getting on with life and living it. Marvin listened to it, connected with it, and sang his butt off on it, and gave it this whole other sexual meaning. DR. He felt the pressure to follow up 1971 conceptual triumph, What's Going On? It was this huge social statement, and he wanted to do an openly sexual album, one that would be unapologetically sexual, meaning Jan Hunter, future wife, while making the album, had a huge impact. Her being a teenager, him being an older man, she emboldened him. And here's a little bit of the Marvin Gaye song, What's Going On?
This is a big party, man. I can dig it. Brother, there's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate.
Jan was the daughter of Barbara Hunter, who is a friend of mine. Her father was jazz singer and hipster Slim Gallard. They came to the studio to see Marvin record, and Marvin fell for her and she for him. They started dating. Marvin Gaye. I write my music according to my lifestyle. If I'm sad, I write sad music. If I'm being divorced, I write divorced albums. If I'm sexy, if I feel hot or horny, I'll write a horny album. Ernie Watts. It was a controversial subject matter for sure, but Motown were behind whatever Marvin wanted to do at this time. He had had What's Going On, and he was like Miles Davis. Whatever he did, everyone wanted to know about it because it was Marvin Gaye. DP. We started doing Let's Get It On, the song. Then Renee Hall stops in a rehearsal and says the song needs something extra and turns to me and says, Don, just make up something at the beginning, can you? I had just bought a wah-wah pedal and I went, okay, here we go. And I go, wah-wah-wah. And that's what the intro, straight off. No overdubs. I played on the Righteous Brothers, You've Lost That Loving Feeling, and I knew that was going to be a hit. I'd played on Ike and Tina Turner's River Deep, Mountain High, and I knew that was going to be a hit. And while I was playing on Let's Get It On, I knew that was going to be a hit too. It was really special. EW. The way they worked at Motown at this time was that they'd record in layers. They'd record the rhythm section first, the keys, drums, bass, guitar, and percussion parts, and then Marvin would do his vocal parts, and then we'd do the horn section parts. Marvin had a studio in Sunset Boulevard where he worked on his vocals. He was a nocturnal guy, and he'd call me in the evenings to come by, and we would trade lines and work on melodies. The main thing about Marvin is that he was very, very serious about his music, and he was very involved with the spiritual aspect of music, the self-improvement, healing side, and we would talk about those things in between working. DR, he was a mystic. He was channeling something. Yes, let's get it on was let's fuck. But there was also a spiritual element. That sentence in the song, we're all sensitive people with so much to give. It was also about let's get our hearts and souls together. And then if you look at the other tracks on the album, there's Distant Lover, which was this anguished, fall on your knees, soul ballad. And then If I Should Die Tonight, where he's contemplating his own death. It ends with Just to Keep You Satisfied, which is him announcing he's leaving Anna, Gordy, wife, and the whole anguish of a ruined marriage. So it's a celebration of sensuality, but it's a whole lot more. There's vulnerability and contradiction. Jim Britt. The sleeve image was important. Motown creative assistant Suzanne DePass told me Marvin had a new album and I was going to go to the studio and shoot the cover for it. I'd already done the sleeve artwork for 1972's Troubled Man and 1973's Diana and Marvin Duets album in one joint session with Diana Ross and Marvin. He was there in his red beanie cap and denim shirt, just his normal everyday clothes. And I spent the whole day shooting him. But I knew the sharp blur shot was the one, and I made a print of it to show Marvin. He was with Norman Whitfield, who goes, "That's the cover." And Marvin goes, "Okay, that's the cover." Years later, Spike Lee bought the print off me for $15,000. E.T., Marvin was a perfectionist and a genius. No doubt about that. He was a complicated man, and he had a reputation for being difficult to work with. But that wasn't my experience. He really worked hard in the studio. He arrived on time, and he was focused. He was a good listener. He took things on board. J.B. Later, Berry Gordy came by to have a look at the sleeve. I had a press proof of the cover and inner gatefold laid out. He was an aggressive kind of guy. I'm 6'2", skinny, and he kind of bumped me out of the way, and he goes, "What's this?" And I said, "It's the cover. Marvin likes it." He was looking at two photos of the gatefold, and he said, "It looks like he's been smoking dope in these." And I told him he had been. And we switched those two photos out. When we finished the recordings, I gave the tapes to Motown, and I told them to call me when the album got to number one. I was that confident. And it was selling so well, Marvin called me after a couple weeks and said, "You gave me a monster." He was elated. DR. The single was number one in September 1973 and was Motown's biggest selling single, bigger than Stop It in the Name of Love and Reach Out, I'll Be There. The album then went to number one. He had this huge success, but the downside for him was Motown wanted him to tour, and he was reluctant to do it. He didn't think he could sing. He had a complex about it. some part of him thought he was a fraud, which was crazy. In the studio, he was happy because you can edit. You can punch in and punch out. And you can work there all night and all day, and there's not an audience judging you. He couldn't shake his fear of being exposed. MG, sometimes I'd throw up before getting out there. That's how scared I was. The first show was at Oakland Coliseum on January 4th, 1974, and it was being recorded live for an album, 1974's Live. It was an orchestra-sized band. We were organized. We had rehearsed beforehand. We knew exactly where we had to be, at what time, and what we were doing. Marvin had performance anxiety, but most performers of Marvin's size had nerves before a performance. It was all part of it. David T. Walker, Gene Page conducted, and Marvin was shy backstage. He was quiet, but the moment he got out on stage, he made it look easy. He led and we followed. It was pure joy on that stage, everyone connecting and buzzing off one another. E.W. He knew he was an important figure in pop and R&B. He knew he had power and influence, and he wanted to use it to make a difference, to make this a more beautiful world. Let's Get It On and the live shows that followed were his way of making the world a more beautiful place. DR. The live album was successful. It reached U.S. number 8 in September 74, and it's very much Marvin's honeymoon period. He's found a new love, he's found a great groove, he's a happy guy, and he's having hits, and it's Welcome to L.A., and this new life he's got there. But Marvin being Marvin, it would not take him long to undercut it all. Sex, love, drugs, and money, or lack of it, would be his undoing. And the classic album review this week is Led Zeppelin III by Led Zeppelin, 1970. The third Led Zeppelin album entered the UK chart at the top a week after starting its four-week run atop the US chart and was certified triple platinum. The inventive cover artwork housed a picture-packed wheel, which could be turned to present different images through cutaway windows in the outer sleeve. The thunderous Immigrant Song became the group's second U.S. top 20 single, but was not released as a single in the U.K., where the group did not release any singles before 1997. The first side of the album delivered the expected high-octane hard rock, but the striking flip side was acoustic-led. Page and Plant, having been particularly inspired by the music of folk artists Bert Janich, John Fahey, and Davy Graham, Gallows Pole features pretty banjo playing alongside John Bonham's thumping drums, while Braun Ye Arre Stomp is highlighted by flights of nifty acoustic guitar picking. The track is named after a cottage in North Wales, owned by friends of Plant's parents, where Page and Plant worked on some of the album's material. Six of the tracks were recorded with a mobile studio in the grounds of a country house in Hampshire, including Tangerine, its eloquent 12-string passages, an early blueprint for Stairway to Heaven, through the West Coast harmonies and country licks were atypical of Zepp. Hats off to Roy Harper, dominated the shimmering slide guitar, is Page's tribute to the veteran English folk singer. Led Zeppelin III showed us a band as capable of subtlety as of heavy metal thunder. And unfortunately, once again, we're all out of time. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the April issue of Mojo Magazine 2024. If you are a big Steely Dan fan like I am, next week I'm going to count down the top 30 Steely Dan songs. And if we have time, I'm going to read the obituary for Mary Weiss. She's a member of the Shangri-Las. And songs like Leader of the Pack, she recently passed away. And a classic album review of Off the Wall by Michael Jackson. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music, saying so long and keep rockin'.